I want to begin in volume 12, February the 24th, at 1919. Man is the masterpiece of the creative power, Jesus says. As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus on coming said to me, "My daughter, you've said nothing about the creation of man." Jesus said, "My daughter, you've said nothing about the creation of man, the masterpiece of the creative power, in whom, not in sprays, but in waves and rivers, the Eternal One poured his love, his beauty, and his mastery. And taken by an excess of love, he placed himself at the center of man." So that's why I give you 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 1 Corinthians 6:16. "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" So the Lord created us for a particular purpose. But God wanted a worthy dwelling place. Because I gave you Hebrews 12:14 many times, that nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So God wanted a worthy dwelling place. So what does this uncreated majesty do? He creates man in his own image and likeness. That's Genesis 1:27 and Romans 8:29. And he draws a breath from the depth of his love, that's Ruach Adonai, or U-A-C-H, A-D-O-N-A-I, the Spirit of God. He drew a breath from the depth of his love, and with his omnipotent breath, he infused life into man. That's Genesis 2:7. He infused life into him, endowing him with all of his qualities proportioned to a creature, making him a little God. So first of all, I want to give you Psalm 8:5 and Psalm 82:6, which is quoted by Jesus in John 10:34. "I said you are gods, all of you sons of the Most High." So "I said you are gods," that's small g. And in the Hebrew, it is Elohim. And when you speak about the triune God, the Hebrew gives you Elohim with a capital E, because God can only make creatures like himself. So he made him a little God. So everything you see in creation was absolutely nothing compared to the creation of man. This is a most astonishing statement. "Oh, how many more beautiful heavens, stars, suns he extended in the created soul." So the soul of man is a whole creation by itself. And when we come to the Lord and give ourselves truly to the Lord, St. Paul calls us a new creation. That's 2 Corinthians 5:7, I think it is. A new creation. So there's a whole creation inside of us. So there's something about the creation of the universe that reflects something about its creator. There's something in us that reflects the one who created us. That's the universe inside of us. And he said how much variety of beauty and how many harmonies he put there. Well, even if you examine the miracle of sight that we have, it is an extraordinary harmony of beauty that is actually there. So when you examine how the ear works, when you examine how the brain works, when you examine how the lungs or the kidneys or any other part of the body works, it's totally fascinating. How much variety of beauty, he said, how many harmonies are there? It's enough to say that God looked at man, at the man he created, and he found him so beautiful as to be enamoured with him and jealous of this beautiful creation that he had made. So the Lord was jealous of the creature that he had made. You'll find that in Exodus 20, verse 5. And you'll find it in Deuteronomy 6:15. So he made himself the custodian of man, that he himself would take care of the creature that he had made. He also made himself the possessor of man, because if you make something, you have the right to possess it. And so we are God's possession. But because of the tragedy that happened in the fall of man and the dreadfully long and tragic journey that the human race has to come back to God, we don't come back to possession of God until we reach union with him. And it's a very long journey for most people, and indeed for the whole human race itself. So God made himself both the custodian and the possessor of man. And he said, I created everything for you. Now you'll read that in Genesis 1, 28 to 30, where a description of the wonderful garden that God created for man is given to you. I give you dominion over everything. Everything is yours. And you will be mine. So God gave us the whole earth. He put man as the king of the earth. He put everything under his feet. That's Psalm 8. What is man that you would even think of him, Lord? Because you are so great that you created the heavens just with your fingers. And yet the extraordinary thing is that you made us little less than a god and crowned us with glory and honor. You put everything under our feet. It's an incredible thing that he said, everything was created for you. I give you dominion over everything. Everything is yours, but you are mine. Now, that's the bit that man rebels against. Man likes being God. Man, in fact, followed the pattern of his seducer, Satan, because Satan rebelled and wanted to be God himself, not somebody like God. And when he seduced Adam and Eve, he told them, you will be like God as well. And this God thing is inside of us, that we want to behave like gods. You see that in particularly in emperors and kings and people in charge of countries and companies and all kinds of things. They act as if they're gods, but we are meant to be his. Jesus continued, you will not be able to understand everything. You will not be able to understand the seas of love and the intimate and direct relations and contacts, the likeness that actually runs between the creator and the creature. But God can only make something like himself. So there's something in us that reflects him. Ah, daughter of my heart, Jesus said, if the creature knew how beautiful her soul is, how many divine qualities it contains, and how among all created things it surpasses everything in beauty, in power, and in light. So much so that it can be said that it is a little God. There's your Psalm 8, 5 and Psalm 82, verse 6 again. And it is a little world which contains everything within itself. Oh, how much more she would esteem herself and would not dirty with the slightest sin a beauty so rare, so portentous a prodigy of the creative power. Now, as we go on in these volumes, you'll hear Jesus saying that he expands our interior and he creates new suns and moons and stars and new universes inside of us. We just have to accept that he says that. If you can actually grasp it, it'd be wonderful. But the creature, he said, in its present condition, is almost blind to knowing who she is, and much more blind to knowing who her creator is. And that's why the human race continuously gets itself into terrible trouble. And so the creature keeps dirtying herself among a thousand filthy things to the point of disfiguring the work of her creator. But of course, that's exactly what the enemy of God and man wants. Satan wants us to dirty ourselves to the point where we're not fit for the kingdom of God anymore, and we will lose the incredible, immeasurable inheritance that's been given to us. So much so that she can barely be recognized. So there you've got the image of the prodigal son in Luke 15. And, you know, when he starts off in his father's house and has such an incredible family and inheritance and future and everything, and then he ends up feeding with the pigs in utter degradation. You have a very graphic description of the fall of the human race there, to the point where the man who returns to his father is unrecognizable. And that's the situation with us. And you know from studying the hours of the Passion that when Jesus paid the price for our redemption, he looked like us. So disfigured he was that he looked no longer human, Isaiah 53 verse 7 says. And so the shocking disfigurement of his body showed us graphically what our souls look like when they are degraded in sin. Because St. Paul says he was made sin for us. He was the perfect picture of sin. It's very frightening. And so the creature, not allowing the beauty of the Creator to manifest itself in her, falls into this terrible situation. Think, Jesus said, you yourself, of what our sorrow is. And therefore, come into my will, and together with me, come to substitute for your brothers. Come and substitute for them before the throne of the Eternal One. I want to give you Romans 8, 29 to 30 there. That if we have grasped in any way the extraordinary privilege that we have in Christ, then of course we will substitute for the others to try and bring them back from their dreadful spiritual sickness. And Jesus said, together with me come and substitute for all the acts which they should do, for having been created as a prodigy of love of my omnipotence, and yet they are so ungrateful. So the vast majority of the human race does not in fact thank and praise God, even for their own creation. So Louisa said, in one instant we found ourselves before the Supreme Majesty, and in the name of all we expressed our love, thanksgiving and adoration for having created us with such an excessive love and endowed us with such beautiful qualities. So Louisa is praying through, with and in Jesus, which the Church has told us from the beginning is the way we must do it. So February the 27th, 1919. In the divine will, there's no hindrance to the love of God. So when Jesus finds somebody actually living in his divine will, he finds no hindrance to the work he actually wants to do, both in us and through us. So Louisa says, continue in my usual state, blessed Jesus in coming, almost always calls me into his will to repair or to substitute for the acts of creatures, but to do it in a divine manner. That's the important thing. If we do it on a human level, it is almost worthless. If we do it on a divine level, it's worthy of God. So on coming, Jesus said, my daughter, what a stench emanates from the earth. So I want to give you Habakkuk 1:13, which says, Lord, you are too holy to look upon sin. Jesus said, I can find no place for myself on the earth. But because of the stench, I'm forced to flee from the earth. Now, there's a big example in Ezekiel chapters 10 and 11 of the Lord actually abandoning the temple in chapter 10 because of their sins, but returning in chapter 11 when they repent. You, however, Jesus said, you can make for me some sweet smelling air, we say incense, which might be suitable for me. If you look at Revelation 8:4, our prayer goes up like incense into the presence of God, and Psalm 141:2 as well. So the sweet smelling air is this incense that might be suitable for me. And do you know how? By doing what you do in my will all the time. That is the secret, that whatever we do it in the divine will and not outside of it. As you do your acts, you will form from me a divine air, we would say atmosphere perhaps, and I will come to breathe it and will find a place of the earth that's fit for me. And since my will circulates everywhere and everywhere, so everywhere, I will feel the air that you will make from me, and it will break the bad air that the earth sends me. So I want to give you Romans 5:20, where sin abounds, grace doth even more abound. So here we have the privilege that when we do our acts in the divine will, we actually create a space, a locus on the earth where the Lord can feel at home because it's his own will. Now, the church is meant to be that local. The physical church is meant to be that locus where the Lord has his own atmosphere and everything to do with his will is done, and therefore that he can reign there. But of course, if the church is going through a bad time and it's not really doing what it should, then he mightn't be there. But if he finds somebody living in the divine will, then in that tiny little space, in that one little creature, he can find his home and his space, and he will still have a throne on earth. So if many, many, many of us come into the divine will, then his throne on earth is increased. One of my friends in the divine will has said that what we're actually doing when we make our acts in the divine will is that we are knitting the red carpet for Jesus' return to the earth. That he won't come to sewerage, he will only come to something that is divine and pure and holy. So then Jesus went away and came back after a little while, and he said to Louisa, "My daughter, how much darkness." Now, first of all, he said, what a stench is coming up from the earth. So that stench means there's rottenness actually there. And none of us like the smell of rottenness. Okay. And this time, how much darkness. So the darkness is a different kingdom to Jesus. Jesus' kingdom is a kingdom of light. So the kingdom of darkness then means that Satan is around. So that's Satan's kingdom. It's such, he said, that the earth seems covered with a black mantle. We would say a pall of death, to the point that they can no longer see. They have either become blind or they have no light in order to see. Now, for that, I want to give you Isaiah 6:9-10. These people see and never perceive. These people hear and hear and never hear. They don't understand because their hearts are hardened by sin. And this prevents them from seeing with their eyes, hearing with their ears, understanding with their hearts, and being converted and live. That's the tragedy of a fallen human race. And when you go to the Gospels, you find that Jesus concentrated on opening the eyes of the blind, unstopping the ears of the deaf, loosening the tongues, softening the hearts, giving new life. In other words, reversing this process completely so that redemption could happen. So that's Isaiah 6:9-10. Also want to give you Psalm 115. And with regard to the blindness, I also want to give you John 9:41, where the Pharisees said to Jesus, "We're not blind, surely." And Jesus said, "If you were, I could heal you. But you claim you can see, so you have to take responsibility." So Jesus then said, "What I want it's not only divine air for me, but also light, because after all, God is light. If there's no light, you've got the kingdom of darkness around. And I want to give you Matthew 5:14, because Jesus told his disciples that they were to let their lights shine so that everybody in the world would see and would give glory to the Father in heaven. Therefore, he said, let your acts be continuous in my will. In other words, keep the lights on. So you will make not only air for your Jesus, but also light. You remember the wise virgins at the wedding? They were the ones who trimmed their lamps and they were ready for the master's return. They had their lights on. The other ones didn't. You will be my reflector, he said. My reverberation. The reflection of my love and of my very light. So I want to give you 2 Corinthians 3:18, that we become like the one we worship. And so if we're living in the divine will and doing these divine acts all the time, then it means that we are reflecting his presence and his light and his love and all the rest. Even more, I tell you, that as you do your acts in my will, you will erect tabernacles for me. In other words, a space where he can be. So 1 Corinthians 3:16 there. Not only this, but as you keep forming thoughts, desires, words, reparations, acts of love, many hosts will be unleashed from you because they were consecrated by my divine will. So you see, therefore, that the person living in the divine will becomes the place or the locus where the Lord can set his throne on earth. And through that person, light and love and life will go out to the world. And many, many hosts that he will consecrate with all of our acts. It's an incredible privilege. Oh, what a free outpouring my love will have, he said. I will have the free field in everything. In other words, he will be able to do the works that he wants to do. And I will have no hindrance. Hindrance, of course, comes from the human will wanting to do something else. And of course, even worse, from sin. I'll have as many tabernacles as I want, so many will I have. The hosts will be innumerable. At each instant, we will communicate each other. Now, when we go to Mass, we receive Jesus, and it's just 15 minutes that he is actually with us, body, blood, soul, and divinity. In the divine will, he's with us all the time. And we communicate each other all the time. Because I keep reminding people that we communicate. That means I receive him and he receives me. At each instant we will communicate each other together. And I too will cry out, freedom, freedom. Come everyone into my will, because that's where you will enjoy true freedom. Outside of my will, there are many hindrances that the soul will find. So not only does the Lord find hindrance if we're not living in the divine will, but the soul herself finds a lot of hindrances in herself and outside of herself. But in my will, the soul is free. I leave her free to love me as she wants. Now, I keep emphasizing this point, that the Lord wants a genuine, individual, unique response from each one of us. If he was to get exactly the same thing from each one of us, we'd bore him to death. He has made each one of us quite unique. And the responses that we should give are also unique, so that he has the variety that he needs. And that he can say, oh, that's my John that's talking. Oh, that's Mary. It's unique. It's individual. Just like when Jesus came back in the resurrection, he said, Miriam. And Mary of Magdala recognized him, because whatever way he pronounced it, Only he did it that way. And she recognized the voice of the shepherd. He wants to recognize our voice as well in the divine will, just as we recognize his. So Jesus said, I love the soul. I leave the soul free to love me as she wants. Even more, I tell her, lay down your human guises. Take those that are divine. He's asking us to take up the divine level. It's really incredible. I'm not stingy and jealous of my goods, he said. I want you to take everything. Love me immensely. He's asking us to love him without limits. Take all my love. Make it your own. Make my power, my beauty, make it your own. The more you take, the happier your Jesus will be. In other words, he has waited all this time for people to live in the divine will, and he wants us to make the most of the opportunity and to do the most that we can with his gifts. You remember the parable of the talents? He was upset with the one who wouldn't do anything with the talent. And that talent that was not used was actually given to the person who used their talents the most, the person with the 10 talents. And according to our way of looking at things, that doesn't seem awfully fair. But the person who had the 10 talents did the most work for the Lord. So to him who has more will be given, and to him who has not, even that which he has will be taken away. The more you take, Jesus said, the more your Jesus will be happy. The earth forms few tabernacles for me. A tabernacle is a place where Jesus can actually stay. If you read John 1:14, when the apostle is speaking about the incarnation of Jesus, he says that the Logos became sarx. That is, the word became flesh, with an infinite distance between the divine Logos and the flesh, which is sarx, and he tabernacled in our midst. He tabernacled, he dwelt. But a tabernacle is something that moves from place to place. It's not just the solid thing that you find in the church, because the term goes back to the tabernacle in the desert, which travelled with the people along their whole journey to the promised land. Now he says the earth, that's people living on a level that's too low, forms few tabernacles for me. The hosts are almost numbered. And then the sacrilegious, the irreverence that they do. So this is the misuse of the sacraments and the Eucharist. And how offended and hindered is my love. In my will, instead, there's no hindrance. And there's not a shadow of offense. And the soul gives me love. The soul gives me divine reparations, and the soul gives me a complete response. That's the 100% that he's actually looking for. And not only that, but she substitutes together with me for all the evils of the human family. Be attentive, he said to Louisa, and don't move from the point at which I call you and that I want you. That is, don't move out of the divine will. That's where he wants you to be 24/7, 365. And he wants you to operate on this divine level. So it's very fitting that the message that comes after this in March the 3rd, 1919, is a comparison between the terrestrial Eden and the divine Eden. And what the Lord wants to tell us is that no matter how beautiful the earthly Eden is described in the book of Genesis, Satan was actually able to enter into it. And the reason is for that, you have to go from Genesis right to the other end of the Bible, to the book of Revelation in chapter 12, where you hear that there had been war in heaven and that Satan and his minions were thrown out because Michael and the good angels actually fought and won the battle. But the extraordinary thing is, you would expect that if Satan and his minions had been thrown out of heaven, that they would be thrown down to hell. But they weren't. They came down to the earth. to do as much damage as possible before they would be finally consigned to hell. And that's why there is continuous spiritual warfare going on the earth. None of us can avoid it. If you think it's not going on, there's something wrong. And so Satan could enter the earthly even Eden and wreak havoc there. But he has no ability to enter the divine Eden to do any damage. So the Lord is trying to entice us now to go into that divine Eden and stay there. So Jesus said to Louisa, "You are my firstborn daughter of my will. How dear and precious you are in my eyes. I will keep you so guarded that if in creating man I prepared a terrestrial Eden," that's of course Genesis 1 and 2, "for you I have prepared a divine Eden." So it's completely spiritual. And it's in an area where Satan cannot enter. Whereas the Garden of Eden on the earth was material, even though it was magnificent. If in the terrestrial Eden, the union between our first ancestors was human, and I gave them to enjoy the most beautiful delights of the earth, while they enjoyed me at intervals. That's very interesting insight. They enjoyed him at intervals, because you read in Genesis 3 that the Lord walked with Adam in the cool of the day. And that language is used because if you've ever been in the tropics, as I lived in the tropics for 7 years, the only time you can walk is for a very short time in the cool of the day before the onset of evening and the onset of night. It's a very short time. Anybody who can walk walks at that particular time. So Jesus said, "I have prepared a divine Eden for you." So in the terrestrial Eden, the first and the relationship between the Adam and Eve was human, even though they had great delights upon the earth and they only enjoyed the Lord at intervals. But in the divine Eden, the union is divine, therefore permanent. "I will make you enjoy the most beautiful celestial delights." That's Psalm 36, verses 8 to 9. The torrents of his delight. Most people have the idea that God is up there on his cloud and he's ready to punish if you move an inch in any direction. They have no idea of the extraordinary joy and peace and love and freedom and exaltation that you experience in a personal relationship with him. "I will make you enjoy the most beautiful celestial delights," Jesus said, "and you will enjoy me as much as you want." That's fully and completely. "Even more, I will be your very life. And we will share together the contentments, the joys, the sweetness, and if needed, the pain." Because she's on the earth, and unfortunately in such a broken society on the earth, it's not possible for us to get through without pain. So Jesus said the enemy, that is Satan, had access to the terrestrial Eden, and of course the first sin was committed because he managed to seduce Eve. But in the divine Eden, entrance is precluded to the devil, as it is precluded to the passions and to weaknesses. So here's the key. I keep on saying that these texts give you the way to discern where you're at in these writings. Because not only is the devil precluded, but passions as well. So if you find that your passions are not brought back into God's order yet, then you haven't arrived. You're only trying to come there. And if your weaknesses have not come under the precious blood of the Lamb and surrendered to him, you're on the way, but you haven't arrived. Even more, Satan does not want to enter the terrestrial, the celestial Eden, knowing that my will would burn him more than the very fires of hell. There's the insight you need. Satan had rebelled against the divine will, and now in his rebellious condition, because angels were only given one chance to make a decision for or against God, and his decision was against God, so it's permanent and eternal, which is very frightening. So coming near that divine will would be like you and I walking towards a pillar of fire. Now, I've actually experienced the pillar of fire in Africa. You need to go to a place like Africa to understand that the things that are described in the book of Exodus are real. I remember the first time I saw a pillar of fire, I was so fascinated. I wanted to go towards it, and somebody grabbed me from behind and said, "A little closer and you will be dead." That is pure electricity. That is pure fire. They said there wouldn't be any remains. There wouldn't even be ash. You'd be destroyed without recognition, without remembrance. And that's what Jesus is saying about the devil. Couldn't go near the divine will because it's like that pillar of fire that would absolutely annihilate him incredibly. It would burn him more than the very fire of hell. And upon merely feeling the sensation of the divine will, Satan flees. That's why there is such incredible divine security in the divine will. And Jesus said to Louisa, "You will give the start to the first acts in the divine manner, which are immense, eternal, infinite, and embrace everything and everyone." So she was to be the one to start it off, and then we come after her in the same vein as well. So Louisa interrupted Jesus and said, "Jesus, my love, the more you speak about this divine will, the more I am confounded. And I fear, and I feel such annihilation that I feel myself being destroyed and therefore unable to respond to your designs." And he, all goodness, added, "It is my will that destroys the human in you." There you've got a statement that you really, really must look at. The divine and the human don't mix. The flesh and the spirit don't mix. And so if we are to allow ourselves to come into that divine sphere, we have to allow him to annihilate the stuff of our previous life. And one of the signs that you are making progress is that you plunge yourself continuously into your absolute nothingness. If you still think something of yourself, you haven't arrived. "It is my will," he said, "that destroys the human in you. And instead of fearing, you should fling yourself into the immensity of my will. My designs upon you are great, they are noble, and they are divine. The very work of creation, oh, how it remains behind this work of calling you to live in the divine will." Now, if you look at the immensity of creation and the wonder of the stars and the galaxies and everything, I absolutely love astronomy. I loved it long before I came into divine will. I always feel that your soul needs to be liberated off the earth and absolutely enter into that divine sphere and get lost up there. That's where you feel at home. He said, "But this incredible work of creation," he said, "remains behind this work of calling you to live in the divine will." So getting us to live in the divine will is a much greater achievement for the Lord. And he said, "I want you to actually live in it." That's 24/7/365. Not just doing a few acts, but actually living there permanently. "I want you to live in it. And I want you to live there, not a human life, but a divine life. This is on the earth. This is why the saints in heaven look in wonder at little creatures like us, little absolute nobodies, living a divine life on the earth. They would have loved to have done that if they had known it. He said, it is a stronger outpouring of my love, getting us to live in his divine will. It is my love constrained by creatures such that, unable to contain it any longer, I pour it in torrents towards the one who loves me. Again, that's your Psalm 36, verses 8 to 9. And in order to be sure that my love won't be rejected and maltreated, I call you into my will, so that neither you nor what is mine may remain without its full effect. So it's only when we allow him to let us drop the human and enter into the divine that we achieve everything that God wants from us, and he achieves everything he wants to do in us. My daughter, do not sadden me with your fears, and do not sadden the work of your Jesus. Continue your flight to where I call you. So March the 6th, 1919. Here Jesus speaks about the different steps that he takes to make a soul come to live in the divine will. You can't do it all at once. One of the funniest things I've heard in a divine will setting is on the very first seminar that we held here in my own house, that when the speaker had gone on for a couple of hours and we stopped to have questions, the first question he was asked was, is there a shortcut? And I think the most appropriate reply was the laughter we gave. There's no possibility of a shortcut. You have to go through the steps that are necessary in your journey. And those steps are not only the spiritual steps that Jesus wants us all to go through, but whatever you did in the past, whatever sins or faults or troubles you had in the past, that ground has to be reversed. And you've got to come back that journey. And so each one of us has a unique journey depending on what we have done in the past. So Louisa said, I was all concerned about why my sweet Jesus keeps telling me about the divine will. And I said to myself, how is it possible that a soul can reach such an extent and live more in heaven than on earth? Now, I would imagine that that question comes more from the priests who are talking to Louisa than from herself. I think she would have accepted it very, very simply. So Jesus said, my daughter, that which is impossible to the creature, anything is possible for me. Now, you find this many times in scripture and almost the same words. So I want to give you Luke 1:35, because that's what the angel said to our Blessed Mother. Nothing is impossible with God. Matthew 19:26. Nothing is impossible with God. Mark 9:23 and 10:27. Now, I could give you loads of examples from the Old Testament, but I'm going to stay there. In the Old Testament, you read it like this. Is the arm of the Lord too short? The arm representing the power of God. So Jesus said, listen, nothing is impossible with God. And I think that little statement is something you might write on a piece of paper and really look at it by itself. It's not impossible for God to make me a saint. Now, it'll take a tragedy, all right, but it's not impossible. It's true that this is the greatest prodigy of my omnipotence. The greatest prodigy is to get us to live in the divine will. So it's the greatest prodigy of my omnipotence and of my love. And when I want, I can do anything. If he wants it, he can do it. And what seems difficult to you is very easy to me. However, I do want the fiat of the creature. I do want the yes of the creature. That she lend herself like soft wax to whatever I want to make of her. Now, this is our job, is the surrender. And we stubborn, rebellious human beings find the surrender difficult because we have a fear that we won't be in control. And adults find that extremely difficult, that they might have to give up the control as to what's happening inside of them. And you see this struggle that Louisa has as well. It always comforts me to read her struggles. I want you like soft wax. So let me give you Jeremiah 18:1-6. It's the potter and the clay. The clay has got to relax in the hands of the potter. And then Romans 9:19-21, where Paul speaks about the potter and the clay as well. And he says something very down to earth, which is that the clay has no right to tell the potter what to do. But we do. One of our great faults as human beings is to tell God what he should be doing. So we have to give our yes, our fiat, like soft wax, so that the Lord can do whatever he wants to make of us. The Lord can do his work in us. So that's Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. And I love those moments in Louisa's writings when Louisa says to the Lord, "What are you doing in there inside of her?" And he says, "I'm touching you up." Okay, so this surrender is in fact the preparation for living in the divine will. And I want you to take this very, very seriously, because you may miss the point that a real, genuine, fine, final surrender is necessary from us. Our Blessed Mother gave her absolute one time only surrender at the incarnation, and look at all the consequences that came from it. We may be inclined to say, "Yes, I give you this bit, or I give you that bit, or I give you the other bit," but we're not doing a blanket yes to everything. And that is the challenge that the Lord is giving to us now. Please lay down your arms. We have to surrender to him, and it's only the surrendered soul that finds paradise on earth. So Jesus continues, "Even more, you must know that before calling the soul definitely to live in my will, I call her every now and then." You see, this is very important. In the beginning, the Lord gives you calls every now and then. And when he sees you becoming more and more and more generous and responding more, it will come to the point where you make the final surrender. So that's why I have said to people, you know, who say the consecration to the divine will frequently, just surrender. The prayer of consecration is beautiful. But what the Lord wants is that you would actually surrender, not just say the words. And someday you have to say, "Lord, this is it. This is the day I surrender. I lay down my arms. I lay down my guns. I lay down my scepter. I'm not ruling my life anymore. You're ruling my life." So he says, "Up to that moment, I call her every now and then. I strip her of everything." So to let us know that he actually really wants us to come to this point, he'll start taking this and taking that and taking the other. And if you struggle desperately in him taking something from you, then it means you're not ready for that final surrender. Not at all. But when we let him strip us of something, no matter how painful it is, and we don't argue and we don't resist, we let him do it, then we're coming close to this point that he really wants. So I make her undergo a sort of judgment, he said. because in my will there are no judgments. The sort of judgment is that you really have to come to grips with yourself. You've got to face the reality of your own person and your own history and your own weaknesses and all the rest of it. You've got to face the truth. And when you let him do that judgment for you now, it's all over. Because if you die in the divine will, you go straight up. I make her undergo a sort of judgment because in my will, there's no judgments. So if we're sincere about this, he will genuinely bring you through a very thorough purification. So when we actually reach the point of the final surrender in the divine will, he said, everything will remain confirmed in me. Everything will be stable from then on. Judgment is outside of my will. So you see, it's only everything that's outside of the divine will that needs to come under judgment and purification. But everything that enters into my volition, who can ever dare to place under judgment? You see, once the soul goes into the divine will in its absolute surrender, then the judgment has happened. And I never judge myself, because from then on we will be inseparable from him. Not only this, but many times I make her die also corporally, and then again I give back life to her. It's very interesting. In my own particular experience of the Lord, I have almost died 5 times. He brings you right to the brink. And in one case, I actually had a death experience, so that you actually see the other side and he gives you a different perspective on life. I make her die also corporally. And then again, I give life back to her. And the soul lives as if she did not live. Her heart is in heaven. In other words, he actually lifts you up to this dimension. So the world and all it stands for becomes unreal to you. So I want to give you 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 5. So her heart is in heaven. And to live on the earth is the greatest martyrdom. Now I'd like you to also read Hebrews chapter 11. Which speaks about the great heroes of old. And it says that they were too good for this earth. And so they went out to live in caves and in mountains and in deserts. And they were persecuted and they were martyred and everything. Their homeland was in heaven. They were looking for their home elsewhere, not on the earth. Now, in this journey from wherever we've come from into the divine will, that is the reality, okay? That the Lord has got to bring us to that place, that we're living in heaven with our feet on earth. And then he said, how many times have I not done this to you? He said to Louisa. These are all the dispositions in order to prepare the soul to live in my divine will. These are all the things that need to happen. And then he said, there are the chains of my graces. And then for her, my repeated visits, he said, how many times have I not given it to you? Everything was to dispose you to the height, that is the summit of living in the immense sea of my will. Therefore, he said, don't want to investigate it, but continue your flight. Now, that means please don't go rationalizing it. Don't think about it too much. Just let it happen. So I think the problem of rationalizing or thinking about it too much would come from the priests who are asking her lots of questions. So I want to give you Psalm 131, verses 1 to 3. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. So indeed is my soul.